The Gift of the Magi. Welcome as we take another look into the life and message of Elizabeth Elliot. She called us to live to a higher standard and to not settle for a shallow substitute instead of what God wants us to have. As our series continues in the coming weeks, we'll hear from family, friends, and others, all influenced by the life and message of Elizabeth Elliot. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Well, today we get to look at one of my favorite Christmas-related stories, a classic called The Gift of the Magi, a tale of love and sacrifice. And as we think about the Gift of the Magi, we'll be thinking as well about gift-giving as strategy for reaching those who have never trusted in Jesus Christ. Also heard today, it'll be Quinn Hood, who works with us here at the Elizabeth Elliot Foundation, as she talks about the importance of obedience in the ministry of Elizabeth Elliot. But let's get to that classic tale, The Gift of the Magi. It's Christmas Eve. What can I do if things are looking bleak? Well, besides crying, it's a story of love, low income, and sacrifice. The Gift of the Magi.
You are loved with an everlasting love. That's what the Bible says. And underneath are the everlasting arms. This is your friend, Elizabeth Elliot, reading today a story by O. Henry, one that's probably familiar to many of my listeners, but I think it's a lovely Christmas story, and it certainly has some lessons for us. It's called The Gift of the Magi, and it's not the Magi in the Bible, as you will discover. $1.87. That was all, and 60 cents of it was in pennies. Pennies saved one and two at a time by bulldozing the grocer and the vegetable man and the butcher until one's cheeks burned with the silent imputation of parsimony that such close dealing implied. Three times Della counted it. $1.87, and the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing to do but flop down on the shabby little couch and howl. So Della did it, which instigates the moral reflection that life is made up of sobs, sniffles, and smiles, with sniffles predominating. While the mistress of the home is gradually subsiding from the first stage to the second, take a look at the home. A furnished flat at $8 per week. It did not exactly beggar description, but it certainly had that word on the lookout for the mendicancy squad. In the vestibule below was a letterbox into which no letter would go, and an electric button from which no mortal finger could coax a ring. Also appertaining thereunto was a card bearing the name Mr. James Dillingham Young. The Dillingham had been flung to the breeze during a former period of prosperity when its possessor was being paid $30 a week. Now, when the income was shrunk to $20, the letters of Dillingham looked blurred, as though they were thinking seriously of contracting to a modest and unassuming D. But whenever Mr. James Dillingham Young came home and reached his flat above, he was called Jim, and greatly hugged by Mrs. James Dillingham Young, already introduced to you as Della, which is all very good. Della finished her cry and attended to her cheeks with the powder rag. She stood by the window and looked out dully at a gray cat walking a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day, and she had only $1.87 with which to buy Jim a present. She had been saving every penny she could for months, with this result. $20 a week doesn't go far. Expenses had been greater than she had calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim. Her Jim. Many a happy hour she had spent planning for something nice for him, something fine and rare and sterling, something just a little bit near to being worthy of the honor of being owned by Jim. There was a looking glass between the windows of the room. Perhaps you have seen a looking glass in an $8 flat. A very thin and very agile person may, by observing his reflection in a rapid sequence of longitudinal strips, obtain a fairly accurate conception of his looks. Della, being slender, had mastered the art. Suddenly she whirled from the window and stood before the glass. Her eyes were shining brilliantly, but her face had lost its color within 20 seconds. Rapidly she pulled down her hair and let it fall to its full length. Now there were two possessions of the James Dillingham Youngs in which they both took a mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch that had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the air shaft, Della would have let her hair hang out the window some day to dry just to depreciate Her Majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon been the janitor with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every time he passed, just to see him pluck at his beard from envy. So now Della's beautiful hair fell about her rippling and shining like a cascade of brown waters. It reached below her knee and made itself almost a garment for her. And then she did it up again, nervously and quickly. Once she faltered for a minute and stood still while a tear or two splashed on the warm red carpet. On went her old brown jacket. On went her old brown hat. With a whirl of skirts and with a brilliant sparkle still in her eyes, she fluttered out the door and down the steps to the street. Where she stopped, the sign read, Madame Sofroni, hair goods of all kinds. One flight up, Della ran and collected herself, panting. Madame, large, too white, chilly, hardly looked the Sofroni. Will you buy my hair? Asked Della. I buy hair, said Madame. Take off your hat and let's have a sight of the looks of it. Down rippled the brown cascade. $20, said Madame, lifting the mass with a practiced hand. Give it to me quick, said Della. Oh, and the next 2 hours tripped by on rosy wings. Forget the hashed metaphor, she was ransacking the stores for Jim's present. She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. There was no other like it in any of the stores, and she had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain, a watch chain, simple and chaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone. It was even worthy of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew that it must be Jim's. It was like him. Quietness and value, the description applied to both. $21 they took from her for it, and she hurried home with 87 cents. With that chain on his watch, Jim might be properly anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the sly on account of the old leather strap that he used in place of a chain. When Della reached home, her intoxication gave way a little to prudence and reason. She got out her curling irons and lighted the gas and went to work repairing the ravages made by generosity added to love, which is always a tremendous task, dear friends, a mammoth task, to repair the ravages made by generosity added to love. Within 40 minutes, her head was covered with tiny, close-lying curls that made her look wonderfully like a truant schoolboy. It's a schoolboy that's supposed to be in school and isn't. She looked at her reflection in the mirror, long, carefully, and critically. If Jim doesn't kill me, she said to herself, before he takes a second look at me, he'll say I look like a Coney Island chorus girl. But what could I do? Oh, what could I do with $1.87? At 7 o'clock, the coffee was made, and the frying pan was on the back of the stove, hot and ready to cook the chops. Jim was never late. Della doubled the fob chain in her hand and sat on the corner of the table near the door that he always entered. Then she heard his step on the stair, away down on the first flight, and she turned white for just a moment. She had a habit of saying little silent prayers about the simplest everyday things, and now she whispered, "Please, God, make him think I'm still pretty." The door opened, and Jim stepped in and closed it. He looked thin and very serious. Poor fellow. He was only 22. And to be burdened with a family? He needed a new overcoat, and he was without gloves. Jim stopped inside the door, as immovable as a setter at the scent of quail. His eyes were fixed upon Della, and there was an expression in them that she could not read, and it terrified her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor disappointment, nor horror, nor any of the sentiments that she had been prepared for. He simply stared at her fixedly, with that peculiar expression on his face. Della wriggled off the table and went for him. "Jim, darling," she cried, "don't look at me that way. I had my hair cut off and sold it, because I couldn't have lived through Christmas without giving you a present. It'll grow out again. You won't mind, will you? I just had to do it. My hair grows awfully fast. Say Merry Christmas, Jim, and let's be happy. You don't know what a beautiful, nice gift I've got for you." Now I'm going to read the next half of the story tomorrow. Do you know what happened? If you haven't read the story, can you guess what happened? But at this point, I want to stop and remind all of us that even though we may have money to buy gifts for the people that we want to give gifts to, there's nothing that means quite so much as something that costs a sacrifice. Especially may I speak to you children who are trying to think what you can give your mother and dad. You know you can't give them anything as big, as fancy, as shiny, as nice as you'd like to, because you don't have that kind of money. Some of you even have to ask your parents to give you some money so that you can go out and buy a present for them. I remember when I got my allowance as a little girl, I got 5 cents a week, and I had to tithe that money, which meant that every other week I had one penny to put in the plate at Sunday school. So in 2 weeks, I would have 9 cents to spend any way I wanted to. So it took me a little more than 2 weeks to save up for the present that I was going to give to my mother. You'd never imagine being able to buy a whole box of candy, a whole box of chocolates they were, for 10 cents. But I was so thrilled to buy that, and I wrapped it up and I gave it to my mother for Christmas, and I was just trembling when she opened the present. And she said, "Well, how sweet, Betts, you gave me a box of chocolates. You know how I love chocolates." And I couldn't resist saying to her, "And Mama, it only cost 10 cents. I thought that was the best part of the whole thing." Well, it wasn't really a very great sacrifice. Some of you may be able to think of something that costs something other than money. The willingness to be obedient. The willingness to do your chores faithfully and cheerfully. I hope you'll listen to the rest of the O. Henry story called The Gift of the Magi tomorrow.
The first part in our two-part look at the gift of the Magi, as we continue and conclude our Christmas stories today. Hey, let's hear from Marge Saint as we think about the gift of the Magi. We think about gift-giving when it came to reaching an unreached tribe in Ecuador. Marge Saint, whose husband Nate Saint was the pilot who was killed in Operation Alka, she tells us about that strategy of gift-giving to reach the Alka, or Waldani, people.
Dayuma had escaped from her tribe of Alkas some 9 years before because of fear. She literally fled from the territory because of killings within her own family, and she was afraid for her own life. A presentation of gifts seemed the next obvious step. Perhaps a carefully planned, regular schedule of gift drops made over a period of time would show the Indians that the intentions of these white men were friendly, and the repetition would gradually convince them.
My husband, Nate, pioneered the spiraling line technique, which was used in the gift drops. Let me tell you what I know about it. He used about 1,500 feet of deep-sea fishing line wound on a reel in the plane. As they flew over the Alka houses, He slowed the plane to 55 miles an hour and held the gifts fastened to the line over the side of the plane. The door had been removed. And then they hooked up the automatic release mechanism made of my broom handle and three pieces of galvanized wire. Slowly, they lowered the gift packet until it well cleared the plane. The airspeed was allowed to come up to 65, and then began the job of reeling out the line with the gift. They continued circling in the plane until the gift was drifting in a small, lazy circle below. The ribbons were fluttering nicely. Finally, the gift seemed to be pretty close to the trees below. It was time for their first attempt. They rolled the turn steeper and held their breath while they lowered their prize to the earth. It wouldn't be ideal for it to hit the water, and it was heading close, close, closer, and plunk. It hit about 2 or 3 feet from the water, directly in line with the path to the house. The Alcas just couldn't miss it, since they probably got their water for cooking right at that spot. In a sense, they had delivered the first gospel message by sign language to a people who were 1/4 mile away vertically, 50 miles horizontally, and continents and wide seas away psychologically.
From the 1962 album produced by Nancy Woolnow, The Alcas Story, that was Marge Saint. Well, later on, we'll hear from Quinn Hood, who works with us here at the Elizabeth Elliot Foundation. When she first heard Elizabeth, what came to mind, that name Elizabeth? Well, it brings to her mind one thing, is obedience. But let's get to that classic tale, The Gift of the Magi. Our conclusion of O. Henry's classic tale of love and sacrifice, and a Bible passage you might not have thought about related to Christmas.
And I will read the rest today, but before I read that, I want to read some verses from the book of Hebrews, which perhaps you don't normally think of as Christmas verses. The book of Hebrews begins with these words: "In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom he made the universe." Now remember that phrase, through whom he made the universe. God made the universe through his Son, Christ. Verse 3 says, "The Son, S-O-N, is the radiance of God's glory, and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word." To put that a little bit more simply, what Jesus was and what men and women saw him to be, and when they heard his words and felt his love, they were seeing what this verse calls the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. What Jesus was, God was. What Jesus is, God is. What the Holy Spirit is, God is. And yet there are three separate persons of the Trinity, as theologians tell us, co-equal, consubstantial, and co-eternal, and yet three persons. It's a mystery. We can never understand it. But one person became human flesh, Jesus Christ. He came down into this world in order that we might see what God is like, so that we might believe that a man can live and walk this earth and eat and drink and get tired and work and do all the things that an ordinary man has to do, and still live a pure and holy life. Jesus showed us that. Christmas is the celebration of his birth, when he became a helpless baby. The story that I began yesterday, The Gift of the Magi, is about a poor couple, Jim and Della, and they live in a rather miserable little apartment, and Della only has $1.87 to buy a Christmas present for Jim. So she goes out and sells her beautiful, long, thick dark brown hair. And Jim comes in, absolutely stunned at the sight of these little curls that now cover her head. "You've cut off your hair," asked Jim laboriously, as if he had not arrived at that patent fact yet, even after the hardest mental labor. "Cut it off and sold it," said Della. "Don't you like me just as well, anyhow? I'm me without my hair, ain't I?" Jim looked about the room curiously. "You say your hair is gone?" he said, with an air almost of idiocy. "You needn't look for it," said Della. "It's sold. I told you, sold and gone. It's Christmas Eve, boy. Be good to me, for it went for you. Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered," she went on with a sudden serious sweetness, "but nobody could ever count my love for you. Shall I put the chops on, Jim?" Out of his trance, Jim seemed quickly to wake. He enfolded his Della. For 10 seconds, let us regard with discreet scrutiny some inconsequential object in the other direction. $8 a week or $1 million a year. What is the difference? A mathematician or a wit would give you the wrong answer. The Magi brought valuable gifts, but that was not among them. This dark assertion will be illuminated later on. Jim drew a package from his overcoat pocket and threw it upon the table. "Don't make any mistake, Dell," he said, "about me. I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut or a shave or a shampoo that could make me like my girl any less. But if you'll unwrap that package, you may see why you had me going a while at first." White fingers and nimble tore at the string and paper. And then an ecstatic scream of joy. And then, alas, a quick feminine change to hysterical tears and wails, necessitating the immediate employment of all the comforting powers for the lord of the flat. For there lay the combs, the set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped for long in a Broadway window. Beautiful combs, pure tortoiseshell with jeweled rims, just the shade to wear in the beautiful vanished hair. They were expensive combs, she knew, and her heart had simply craved and yearned over them without the least hope of possession. And now they were hers, but the tresses that should have adorned the coveted adornments were gone. But she hugged them to her bosom, and at length she was able to look up with dim eyes and a smile and say, "My hair grows so fast, Jim." And then Della leaped up like a little singed cat and cried, "Uh-oh!" Jim had not yet seen his beautiful present. She held it out to him eagerly upon her open palm. The dull, precious metal seemed to flash with a reflection of her bright, an ardent spirit. "Isn't it a dandy, Jim? I hunted all over town to find it. You'll have to look at the time 100 times a day now. Give me your watch. I want to see how it looks on it." Instead of obeying, Jim tumbled down on the couch and put his hands under the back of his head and smiled. "Dell," he said, "let's put our Christmas presents away and keep 'em a while. They're too nice to use just at present. I sold the watch to get the money to buy your combs. And now, go ahead and put the chops on." The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men, who brought gifts to the baby in the manger. They invented the art of giving Christmas presents. Being wise, their gifts were no doubt wise ones, possibly bearing the privilege of exchange in case of duplication. And here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of two foolish children in a flat, who most unwisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that of all who give gifts, these two were the wisest. Of all who give and receive gifts, such as they are the wisest. Everywhere, they are the wisest. They are the Magi. Do you remember the story of the Magi? Let me read it to you in this last minute or so. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route.
Yes, the conclusion of The Gift of the Magi. Well, before we go, let's hear from Quinn Hood, who works with us here at the Elizabeth Elliot Foundation. She's an administrative assistant. And when she thinks about the name Elizabeth Elliot, what comes to mind? Well, obedience is one of the key words. And that Elizabeth wrote about different stages of life.
I think we all would say obedience, but also I would say confidence. Confidence in the Lord. I know from reading her books that that confidence was hard fought. You know, she wrestled with God early on, wrestled with God to know his will for her life, and then wrestled with God through suffering to really understand just the purpose of his suffering. So I think she came out of that with just such confidence. But if you read, you know, about her early adulthood, you know, she didn't always feel that confident, you know. And I don't know. So that's helpful for me to know that with God, you can get to a place of just fully trusting his will for your life, you know, and fully trusting his word in such a way that you just confidently share that wisdom with, you know, countless others on the radio and books, whatever. So I would say confidence, but I would say that was a hard fought for confidence, if that makes sense.
Quinn Hood of the Elizabeth Elliot Foundation. Well, as our time together comes to an end, let me thank you for letting us come into your home, your office. Maybe along with you, you took a walk and enjoyed a break maybe from some holiday busyness, wherever we found you today. On behalf of the Elizabeth Elliot Foundation, in cooperation with the Bible Broadcasting Network, let me invite you to check out elizabethelliot.org for more talks, devotionals, Gateway to Joy programs, videos, and more. And if you get a chance, leave a review for us sometime. From Running Chic and Kneesy comes this comment. My mother and I began listening to E.E., Elizabeth Elliot, in the mid-1980s. I credit E.E. for helping my mother and I become strong Christian women. My mother has passed away now, and I still relish everything E.E. teaches. She wasn't ashamed of the true gospel and declares it openly and clearly. The principles she teaches are from the very Bible itself, and they transform a person's life. I'm a living testimony of that. We appreciate your making that comment on Apple Podcasts. Until next time, may God remind you each and every day, you are loved with an everlasting love, and underneath are the everlasting arms.